This is Sea Change Radio, covering the shift to sustainability. I'm Alex Wise.
We've just got to trust that citizens' voices will eventually make their way felt, but the timing is what's scary, and it's got to happen quicker than not, and the leadership is certainly not there at the moment.
What makes a great leader? This week on Sea Change Radio, we're honored to have Pulitzer Prize-winning presidential historian Doris Kearns Goodwin here to give us her take on that question. Goodwin's book, Leadership in Turbulent Times, just released in paperback, re-examines four U.S. presidents she's studied in the past, Abe Lincoln, Teddy and Franklin Roosevelt, and Lyndon Johnson. She discusses the contrast between these presidents' leadership and the behavior of the current grifter-in-chief, puts today's impeachment proceedings in historical context, and hypothesizes about how past presidents might have addressed momentous issues like climate change and election tampering. Then we dig into the Sea Change Radio archives and listen to Rebecca Vallis, a vice president at the Center for American Progress, talk about the Trump administration's absurd claims that poverty and hunger are now things of the past in this country. I'm joined now on Sea Change Radio by Doris Kearns Goodwin. She is a biographer, historian, and political commentator, and her latest book, which just came out in paperback, is entitled Leadership in Turbulent Times. Doris, welcome to Sea Change Radio.
Thank you. I'm glad to be with you.
Oh, it's a pleasure. I'm a big fan of your work. Why don't you first kind of give us the snapshot of what inspired you to reinvestigate or look through a different lens at these four presidents?
Sure. I mean, I've spent five decades of my life, it seems, living with presidents who are no longer alive, waking up with these dead guys in the morning and producing these big fat biographies about their lives from the time they're born until they die and their families and a real narrative history. And each time I moved from one president to the next, I sometimes would feel guilty like I were leaving an old boyfriend behind because I'd have to take all of those books out of my study, bring the new guy in. So when I finally finished Teddy and Taft, the last big book that I wrote, I started to think about who am I going to write about next. And instead, I thought, what if I just look at the people I was closest to and knew the best, spent the most time with, through the lens of leadership? It's something I've been interested in since grad school at Harvard, when we'd stay up at night debating the questions, are leaders born or made? Where does ambition come from? So I ended up going to the two Roosevelts, Abraham Lincoln and LBJ, and really just focusing on how did they become leaders, how did they get through adversity, and how did they finally lead? And turned out to be so much fun to try and compare them, contrast them, see what they had in common. And it was called Leadership in Turbulent Times 6 years ago because they all lived through turbulent times. I didn't realize how relevant it would be today. So, of course, everybody thinks I must be talking about the current president. But these guys, I think, have a lot to teach any current president about what leadership is.
The only person out of those four that you actually knew was LBJ. And it sounds like you have fondness for him.
No, it certainly developed it. I mean, I was a White House fellow when I was 24. He chose me to come even though he knew I'd written an article against him, how to remove Lyndon Johnson in 68 because I'd been against the war in Vietnam, and said, oh, bring her down here for a year, and if I can't win her over, no one can. So I did end up working for him and then going to the ranch to help him on his memoirs. And it was a great experience that I think led to my becoming a presidential historian.
And you didn't know Abraham Lincoln, I believe, but reading your depiction of him makes me feel much closer to knowing this person who we think of in mythical terms. A lot of times in history, when you read about Abraham Lincoln's early life, it's almost in these apocryphal kind of George Washington chopping down the cherry tree kind of stories. But you actually give us a much clearer picture of the hardscrabble life that this man had. It was pretty stark. He came from very humble roots, to say the least. But you say that after he walked 100 miles to get to this town where he had a job as a clerk, looking kind of odd in his ill-fitting clothes and being tall and just kind of a funny-looking guy, In 8 months, he was a state senator. And you say that he was likable. And that made me wonder, how much does being a likable person play into a leader being a success?
You know, it's a really good question. I mean, I think in Lincoln's case, when he was, you're right, he was a clerk in a general store, and people knew that he was reading a book in every spare moment he could find. They brought him books to read. They cared about his upward climb, and they respected this young man who was trying to move so far beyond where he had grown up, growing up in a land where he said he had only had probably 12 full months of schooling and never stopped reading. You know, reading for him was like breathing. And then when he runs for office, he delivers this incredible handbill where he says that every man has this peculiar ambition. Mine is to be esteemed of by my fellow man, to be worthy of their esteem. So it wasn't simply, you know, that he was likable. It was that they somehow felt part of his rise to power. And he was good to the people in the town. He would help them out. And they saw early on what the country saw much later on, that this was an unusual character in their midst.
And I think of the likability aspect as a parent. I see my 12-year-old daughter respond much better to positivity than kind of top-down leadership parenting style. We always think of these people like General Patton as being these tremendous leaders, but I can't help but think that somebody like an Abe Lincoln, or even when you look at, I hate to use a sports analogy, but looking at quarterbacks who have to be the field generals, the leaders of a team. Everybody, for example, who's played with Tom Brady raves about him being just a generally good guy. How much do you think that helps somebody inspire people on a mass level as being a president?
Oh, it's really interesting. I mean, I think, you know, when you think about it, you would assume that most of the people that are regarded as great leaders are able to make the team feel that they're part of something larger than themselves. They treat them well. They share credit. They take blame. And that's not always true. I mean, General Patton may not have been that way. LBJ, at times, when he was in the new National Youth Administration, he was really tough on the people who worked for him. Unlike, it's sort of going against the grain of what I think is general. I think the positivity that your 12-year-old daughter responded to is the way you would want almost all of the leaders to behave. But every now and then you can have somebody like a Steve Jobs or maybe a General Patton or LBJ in the early days, and even though he could take off the head of somebody in public and yell at them, and then people were asked, why did you stay with him? And they felt they were in the presence of somebody who was changing things for the better. In the NYA, he was the best national youth director in the country, and they were getting people jobs, young people, and they felt there was a sense of purpose that combined them. And maybe people who worked for General Patton or Steve Jobs felt the same way. But by and large, that emotional intelligence that involves treating people well, being able to understand them, empathize with them, and being a leader that way is what works most of the time.
And you mentioned that you did not reference the current president. Let me read to you a quote I read from a reviewer, Sheldon Stern, from the History News Network. He writes, Goodwin's goal this time is to extract and identify the common cords of leadership that unite the four subjects of her previous work. In doing so, Goodwin, in fact, does not ignore Donald Trump. He is referenced and exposed, though unnamed, by contrasting example on virtually every page of her dissection of Democratic leadership. And I echo that sentiment. The contrast was very stark. Was it a conscious effort while you were writing it, or did you start this before the current situation that we find ourselves?
No, and indeed. I started it, you know, 6 years ago, and so I wasn't thinking of President Trump at the time. But, you know, as it turns out, these human qualities that you're looking for in a leader, you know, the ability to have humility, empathy, resilience, to surround yourself with strong-minded people who can disagree with you, the ability to control negative emotions and to transcend past slights and resentments and to transform the ambition for self into an ambition for the greater good. I mean, those qualities stand in contrast without mentioning the word. And I think it's really important right now that people think about what it means to them, whether or not the ideology that they might agree with or whether or not they've been feeling good about some of the things that Trump's been able to achieve in the corporate tax world, or if they care about deregulations. They have to ask, is this the kind of leader that is good for the country? Is this the kind of leader that's raised the stature of the country? And not just for Trump. I mean, I think we have to look at the 2020 election for the Democrats and figure out not just who thinks who in a debate and who, you know, is able to raise the most money and who has the public opinion polls at that moment, but what kind of leaders have they already been? They've all come from somewhere. They've been leaders as mayor, governor, congressman, senator, and we should be judging them through, you know, what I'd like to call a leadership index, that these great leaders show what they had. And then if we judge them against them, we look at the teams they've built, we look at how they've inspired people, we look about the positivity you talk about with your daughter and see have they exhibited that. And that's the kind of person. They're going to grow in office, but they're not going to change fundamentally.
Yes, and I can't help but urge our listeners and every American to do their best to shake the hand of as many of these Democratic nominees as possible, because I think there's something to be said for how do you feel after saying a few quick hellos to somebody? Do you walk away from that interaction feeling better about yourself? That usually says a lot about how a leader is going to fare on a mass scale. Does that person make you feel better about yourself meeting them?
Right. That's what it is. I mean, that's one of the things that Frances Perkins, who was the first female cabinet officer, and she was his Secretary of Labor under FDR, she said when she came out of a meeting with FDR, even though she had enormous challenges to face, obviously with jobs and labor during the Depression, she said she felt better about herself somehow, that he had confidence in her, and that was contagious, and then she had more confidence in herself. So you're right, in a human touch, and that's why every now and then I get frustrated with the whole primary system. It just seems crazy that small states can determine so much. And yet, on the other hand, people get to see these people up close. And you can tell if somebody's authentic. You can tell whether or not there's a warmth. You can tell not just by listening to their words, but by interacting with them. So the extent to which people actually do shake the hands of people in Iowa or New Hampshire before the big states come underway probably makes a difference.
Willie lived in a cabin way down by the creek. He ran through the dust into his bare feet. But they didn't know that one fine day that he would rule this USA and be the best leader in all the land. Yes, young Abe Lincoln make a tall, tall man.
Young Abe Lincoln make a tall, tall man.
This is Alex Wise on Sea Change Radio, and I'm speaking with Pulitzer Prize-winning presidential historian Doris Kearns Goodwin. So, Doris, I just watched an interview you did on MSNBC with Brian Williams, and he asked you about the resiliency of our democracy in the face of another impeachment proceeding, and you had a pretty optimistic viewpoint and said, you know, we have a resilient system, and we're going to get through this like we've gotten through. And you listed a bunch of the barriers that we've had to overcome as a people and a society and as a country. But I couldn't help but think as I heard that, that there's two things that throw a wrinkle in my positivity about the future. One is climate change. And there's really nothing like that that a leader has faced in our country or any other country. And the other is our elections being possibly tampered with. Why don't we start with climate change? There's really nothing like that in history. How do you think a leader like Abe Lincoln or Teddy Roosevelt might have approached it?
I mean, you have to hope that what they would have understood is that it's the central issue of the time. I mean, whether or not for Lincoln it wasn't there then, but slavery was the issue that had to be dealt with. And he was able to educate the country and to make them understand why this went against the ideals of who America was gradually, and he was able to change public sentiment about it. And so were the anti-slavery movement. I mean, I think the encouraging thing about climate change, you know so much more about this than I do, is that the people are ahead of the government right now, certainly the government in power. And I mean, I know I have a godchild who cares so much about climate change. It determines what she eats. She only wants to have old clothes. And there's lots of young people like her that I think understand this as an existential challenge to the country. And where we've always made the biggest changes in the country are when it comes from the citizens up. It was the anti-slavery movement, as Lincoln said, not him as a liberator, that made slavery come to an end. It was the progressive movement in the states and the cities, the social gospel movement, the settlement house movement before Teddy and Franklin Roosevelt, and the civil rights movement before Lyndon Johnson, and the women's movement, and the environmental movement, the climate change movement. So we've just got to trust that citizens' voices will eventually make their way felt, but the timing is what's scary, and it's got to happen quicker than not, and the leadership is certainly not there at the moment, on the contrary.
Yes, and having these voices heard is key to any democratic process, and shifting to elections and them being in doubt. How do you think a leader like, I don't know, let's say FDR would have dealt with the possible tampering of an election? Would he have tried to rise above it and gotten turnout so high that it would have overwhelmed any kind of questions that people have had about it? Or do you think he would have made people aware of gerrymandering and election tampering in terms of access to the ballot box? I mean, this is something that LBJ had to confront during Jim Crow.
During voting rights, yes, exactly. No, I think you'd have to do both. I mean, you have to make people realize that when people are denied the right to vote, you know, by all sorts of means in various states, when you've now got ballots in certain states that passed in the midterms, four states, I believe, to draw nonpartisan commissions instead of the congressional way that their boundary lines are drawn by partisan means. You've got people arguing about getting money out of politics, so that there's so much that has to be done. The political system itself has to be reformed. But at the same time, I think, and I remember Teddy Roosevelt, right before he was running in 1904, his opponent, the Democratic opponent, came out and accused him of having made some sort of deals with corporations by threatening them in order to have them contribute to the Republican Party. And everybody said, don't even countenance this thing. It's so stupid. And he said, I have to deal with it. And he calls a group of the press together, and he says, this is a falsehood. This is a wicked falsehood. This is an atrocious falsehood. I want absolute proof that this has been done, which, of course, the Democrat couldn't provide, and he wins the election big. So sometimes I think you have to confront this, but I think the biggest thing is what you suggested. You just have to call for the biggest turnout possible among the people who care about the issues that you care about, especially with climate change. And you've got to get young people aboard who feel it a lot because it's their generation, older people who care about what's going to happen to their children and their grandchildren. And then if it's big enough, then the election tampering is not going to be. We've had these elections that have been decided by 10, 20, 30, 5,000 people. And if it's big enough, then they're not going to be able to have that much power to do it.
I know you've got to run, but lastly, which of the four presidents that you profile in this book would you like to see be Speaker of the House during this impeachment proceeding?
Oh, wow. So you'd want a lawyer, obviously, probably. So they all were except for LBJ. But I think probably Teddy Roosevelt would be the best person to confront this situation today in terms of answering back to what's going on and being able to fight for the right, as he would say.
The book is out in paperback. It's called Leadership in Turbulent Times, Doris Kearns Goodwin. Doris, thanks so much for being my guest on Sea Change Radio.
Oh, you're so welcome. I'm so glad I could be part of your show. It's a really important thing you're doing.
When the president talks to God, does he fake that drawl or merely nod? Agree which convicts should be killed, where prisons should be built and filled, which voter fraud must be concealed when the president talks to God?
I'm joined now on Sea Change Radio by Rebecca Vallis. She's a vice president at the Center for American Progress. Rebecca, welcome to Sea Change Radio.
Thanks so much for having me on.
So, Rebecca, you were talking about how the White House Council of Economic Advisors has declared poverty over, and you concisely presented some facts of poverty on Twitter where you say, let me just give a few of them. Nearly half of U.S. households are struggling to afford basics like food, housing, and health care. 4 in 10 Americans don't have $400 in the bank. 5.3 million Americans are living in third world conditions of poverty, per the United Nations. So poverty most definitely exists in this country. When the council of economic advisors was looking at these indicators. You say they cherry-picked data. Do you know if there's any kind of history in place of the White House Council of Economic Advisors evaluating poverty over the years? Can we look at some kind of a curve and all of a sudden is there some kind of an enormous dip in terms of poverty levels according to their metrics? I mean, is there any kind of consistency in looking at the data from what you can glean?
I think that that's one of the things that's just so incredibly notable about this report is that it's such a departure from what serious economists and serious thinkers when it comes to poverty and the economy know to be useful when it comes to looking at poverty. And that's this their selection of a statistic that has never been meaningful or helpful for assessing poverty and hardship. So it basically is, if you were to wake up in the morning and take a look at every possible way that you could assess poverty and hardship and try and find the one that's going to make poverty disappear, you would pick this measure. And that's part of why I'm labeling it a poverty denial measure. That's the thing it's best at doing.
So let's pick apart the report a little bit. You provided some quotes here, and I'm going to read them for our listeners. This is from the report. Quote, "One of the most basic human needs is shelter. Fortunately, homelessness is rare in the United States. On a given night in January 2017, 99.9% of people had shelter and 99.8% were housed, not in a homeless shelter. Throughout the year, 99.6% of people will not spend a single night in a homeless shelter." And this is Department of Housing and Urban Development, HUD study from 2017. How did they come across these numbers, do you surmise?
Well, I mean, it's like if you were taking a look at, say, disease rates, right? And you were to say, oh, well, cancer is rare. The vast majority of Americans never end up experiencing cancer at any point in their lives, and therefore cancer is not a pressing problem. That's basically what they've decided to do, is to try to flip numbers on their head to say, just because most people in this country aren't going to experience, say, homelessness tonight, that means that we don't need to worry about the 500,000 Americans who don't have shelter on any given night, which I would note includes 58,000 families with children. That's the kind of logic that they're using. And I think it's sort of mental gymnastics that you have to go through to get to a place where that's how you're presenting information. But I think it reflects how desperate they are to try to put a rosy spin on an economy that's only working for ultra-rich people like Vern Buchanan, who now has his shiny new yacht that he bought the same day as he voted for the tax law.
I guess it's most troubling because it comes from these supposed experts. It's kind of, that's why I drew the parallel with the Supreme Court. I would expect this from like the NRA giving a report on the heels of another mass shooting saying, yes, there are hundreds of thousands of shootings every night, but there's millions of people who own guns who haven't shot anybody today.
It's exactly right. It's the same exact logic, which I think is why most people, when confronted with what the White House is trying to do here, I think would agree this is absurd on its face, and it shows a level of desperation that I think describes a White House who is starting to realize how unpopular their agenda is and that they need to try and turn things around heading into the midterms.
Let me read you another quote that from your thread. Quote, "Another basic need is food. As with shelter, the vast majority of Americans have reliable access to food. The U.S. Department of Agriculture conducts an annual survey assessing, quote, food insecurity, not hunger, experienced by Americans. While 12.9% of people lived in households defined as food insecure in 2016, this includes households which always had sufficient food, but at some point during the year had difficulty in obtaining food or reduced diet quality as a consequence of limited resources." So break that down for us if you can.
I mean, it's basically a memo to folks who are struggling to figure out where their next meal is going to come from and telling them, I'm sorry, I don't think what you're actually experiencing is hunger, right? I mean, back to just how out of touch this is a group of wealthy, overeducated, frankly, white dudes who are looking out at people who are experiencing real life every day and saying, I'm not sure how I'm going to feed my family. And they're basically telling them, that's what this paragraph you just read does. You know, I don't know that you should be complaining about being hungry, because difficulty obtaining food or reducing your diet quality as a consequence of limited resources, we don't think those really count as hunger. And so we're gonna need you to prove a little harder that you're struggling to feed your family for us to really care and think that it's our problem. That is basically what that paragraph does.
And completely ignores obesity and food deserts, as you mentioned, the ability to have a sustainable, healthier diet is not available to millions of Americans.
That's exactly right. And so I said it before, I'll say it again, it's about 40 million Americans who struggle with hunger in any given month. And I think that they would be quite surprised to learn that the White House has ended hunger.
You mentioned how a lot of this is playing to the base. And I think that Trump's white voter base looks at a report like this and says, you know, that's not me. I'm not fat. And I see a lot of poor fat people in this country that don't look like me. And so I can buy into that. How can there be hunger when there's so many overweight people? Not kind of connecting the dots between food insecurity and obesity. And similarly, the idea of welfare and food stamps, somebody else needs them. It doesn't. You said that, yes, this is going to affect Trump's voter base, but I don't think his base looks at themselves in that same light. Why would they vote against their self-interest if they understood what those interests were? It's kind of gets us back to like Thomas Frank's What's the Matter with Kansas? People consistently voting against their own self-interest.
I think you're hitting the nail right on the head here, which is that Trump realizes that his voter base is the population that is most at risk of being hurt by his agenda. He's trying to tackle some kind of a problem that has to do with other people. And that's why he's dressing up his cuts in this makers and takers frame and trying to call everything that is in his crosshairs, quote, welfare, that well-worn racial dog whistle. What he's hoping to do here is to distract his voters from the fact that they are getting actively screwed every way from Sunday by the guy that they elected, while throwing red meat to his base in the form of that racial dog whistle of the welfare with a capital W. And that is really what this is all about.
The Vice President for Poverty at the Center for American Progress, Rebecca Vallis. Rebecca, thanks so much for being my guest on Sea Change Radio.
Thanks for having me on.
Sway the future to the past and find what will endure.
You've been listening to Sea Change Radio. Our intro music is by Samford Lewis, and our outro music is by Alex Wise. Additional music from Boys from County Nashville, Johnny Horton, and Bright Eyes. Check out our website at seachangeradio.com. That's seachangeradio.com to stream or download the show or subscribe to our podcast. Visit our archives there to hear from Bill McKibben, Van Jones, Paul Hawken, and many others. And tune in to Sea Change Radio next week as we continue making connections for sustainability. For Sea Change Radio, I'm Alex Wise.